Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life, and by the Coriell Institute for Medical Research.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mike and Scott. When I was 5, I got a little yellow parakeet. That was me. Bailey Morell has a different story.
My grandpa bought me my first heifer off the Reno stage when I was 5 years old.
That's right. She was in kindergarten and on her way to becoming a cattle rancher. Bailey just turned 18. She lives on her family's 160-acre ranch. It's about an hour north of Sacramento. They raise Herefords.
So Herefords are those awesome cattle with the red bodies and white faces.
But in recent years, one of the worst droughts in the region's history threatened her family's way of life.
Our water district had no water to sell to us. There was no opportunity to irrigate our crops or our pastures. Our land had to go fallow.
So the land just sat there, dried up and useless. They had to sell a lot of their herds.
It was a lot of hard nights deciding which cows we were going to send to the auction yard for not the prices that we would have liked, because even the cattle market dropped.
They started looking for water on their land.
We drilled 4 test holes for wells, and all of them came up dry. We did everything we could to save the water that we had because we didn't have enough, and that was huge for my family.
They wondered about the future.
What we could do, if it was even worth it anymore.
Scientists warn that devastating droughts could become more frequent and intense with climate change and warming temperatures. But Bailey says her family decided they'll do whatever it takes to adapt.
Our hearts are still in agriculture. And no matter what the world throws at us, we're going to have that relation to agriculture.
They invested in a new irrigation system that conserves water. They moved the herds around more to allow the pastures to recover.
And do what I could on my end to prepare.
On this episode, as temperatures rise and crazy weather becomes the new normal, droughts, hurricanes, heat waves, what are we going to do to adjust, to adapt, and to survive?
Hope is not a passive emotion. There's a lot that we need to do.
What we're facing right now is really a race against time.
Taking carbon dioxide that's captured, putting it someplace where it can be stored over very long time periods.
It is about us having to live in a world that we did not create.
The new United Nations report on climate change moves the target in terms of global warming. Scientists used to think that limiting warming to 2 degrees Celsius would be enough. Now they are saying we have to limit warming to 1.5 degrees or face dire consequences, extreme weather and conditions that will destroy lives, infrastructure, and endanger our food supplies. The report urges sweeping changes in all aspects of economy and society. That means changing our lives, our habits. Let's get started with an example of changing habits related to trash. Mountains of it end up in landfills every year. As that waste decomposes, it releases methane, one of the most potent greenhouse gases. Incinerating trash also pumps a lot of carbon emissions into the air. There's one small town that's creating a blueprint of sorts for doing trash differently. Reporter Sonia Narang used to live in Japan, and she takes us to a rural community known as a zero-waste town.
It's not yet 8 a.m., and the recycling center in Kamikatsu is already bustling with activity. A steady stream of residents arrive and unload trunks full of bottles, cans, and paper items. They separate recyclables into dozens of clearly labeled bins lined up in neat rows. Kamikatsu is a small town of about 2,000 people in the forested mountains of Japan. The waste collection center here runs a tight ship, and everything is carefully sorted and arranged with the help of staff. There are whopping 45 different categories of recyclables, and the town recycles 80% of its trash. Akira Sakano heads up the town's Zero Waste Academy. That's a nonprofit organization that manages the recycling program. Every resident gets a thick booklet of recycling guidelines to learn as they go.
We have, let's say, newspapers, cardboard, scrap papers, shredded papers, paper container with aluminum packaging on the back.
They have nine cups, subcategories just for paper, even paper with aluminum on it. Akira walks me through the waste recycling center. So what are you doing?
So this is a magnet, so we can sometimes check using the magnet to segregate aluminum or metal.
She pokes the magnet around in the bin to see if it catches any metal cans mixed in with the aluminum. Before Kamikatsu adopted its zero waste policy in 2003, the town used to burn all its trash in incinerators. Officials realized how that impacts the environment and people's health. Recycling also has an economic benefit.
It costs six times less for recycling or how we manage the waste right now compared to incinerating everything.
Trash pickup is not a thing here. There are no garbage trucks in this town. Almost everyone has to bring their waste in themselves. For the older residents who can't drive themselves to the recycling center, the town does send a pickup truck. I hitch a ride with the driver, Kazuyuki Kiyohara. Kazuyuki is really concerned about using the Earth's resources wisely, and he's super gung-ho in his personal life about the whole recycling thing. He's got more than a dozen separate bins at home.
I have metal bottle caps, plastic bottle caps, milk containers, soft plastic packaging from laundry detergent, plastic trays, plastic wrappings and containers.
And he keeps going.
Paper, mixed paper, cardboard, and garbage to be incinerated. That's about it.
He's so intense, he even inspects his family's trash.
I give them a final check. I give my family members instructions on how to wash recyclables properly at home. And after they wash an item, I check it. And I go, it's still dirty. Then they go, ah! And I ask them to wash it again.
That's right. You have to wash and dry all your food packaging. Many locals say that's the most annoying thing. Back at the recycling center, I catch Daichi Hyakuno as he unloads bags of juice cans, plastics, and dirty diapers. He moved here from Osaka a few years ago.
At first, I was quite confused because the categorization was so detailed. It was easier in Osaka, since all I had to do was separate the trash into burnables and non-burnables. Here, the categorization is so much more detailed. So there was a lot I didn't understand. It was tough.
It's a lot of work. As a single father of two small kids, he says he's too busy to sort out and wash and dry juice cartons. He's not a big fan of all this.
I wonder why we have to do this much. But as a Kamikatsu resident, I have no choice but to separate my recyclables, and I will continue to do so.
15 years ago when I lived in Japan, I remember I had to write my name in big black letters on clear trash bags. It made me feel so conscious about what I threw away. If I left even one bottle in there, the town wouldn't pick up the trash, and everyone would see my bag left out there on the curb. Akira Sakano from the Zero Waste Academy says it takes time to get people to buy in, but once they learn, there's no going back.
Japan has, of course, good or bad, this kind of social pressure. If everyone's doing it, and then maybe you need to do it, that's a social pressure. So people got used to it. So it's how they change the customs. And once the custom is changed, then it becomes habit.
Kamikatsu is gaining international attention. Now outsiders are flooding here to take workshops at the academy. On the day I visit, folks from a Japanese branch of the clothing company, Patagonia, are here to learn.
Yes. Very famous.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
And well beyond the small town, people are recognizing that reducing how much you throw out could be a big step in the global battle against climate change. For The Pulse, I'm Sonia Narang.
We're talking about climate change, and on the one hand, we have this new UN report that says we have to limit global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius or face really terrible consequences, extreme weather and conditions that would threaten our lives, destroy our infrastructure, endanger our food supplies. And then, on the other hand, we have our habits, our comforts, so many conveniences we've become used to. We just heard that guy who lives in the zero waste town talking about how much of a pain it is to sort and wash all of his trash. So we really have to ask ourselves, are we ready to make big changes? For example, to quickly move away from all fossil fuels, no matter what. I talked about the costs and benefits with Benjamin Preston. He is an environmental policy researcher at the RAND Corporation.
Any type of action, doing nothing about climate change or taking very aggressive actions to combat climate change, all of these decisions come with significant trade-offs. It would require mobilizing absolutely massive amounts of investment. And certainly this comes with consequences. Investing so much wealth and resources into combating climate change means there would not be resources to achieve other societal goals and objectives.
What about my wallet? I mean, we've all benefited from cheap gas prices, from low prices of electricity, and so on and so forth. So how would things change in that regard?
Yeah, absolutely. So obviously a big concern and potential barrier to making these kinds of changes is what are the costs associated with that? And perhaps more importantly, who bears those costs? So as soon as you approach consumers and say, look, we have to combat climate change, but in so doing, it means you're going to have to pay more for energy and electricity. You're going to have to pay more for food and water because of changes being made in those sectors. That certainly gets the attention of the general public. It gets the attention of consumers and can lead to pushback in terms of some of the policies and actions that are being promoted to fight climate change. You know, when we talk about climate change, we're talking about it at the global level. We talk about international agreements and federal policy, but these things do trickle down to hit people in the wallet.
We often look for a bad guy or somebody to blame, and in all of this, so energy companies are a target, and people blame them in a lot of ways for our continued reliance on fossil fuels. Is that fair? And are energy companies doing things to change what they are doing?
Yeah, well, I think there's no question that the energy sector is, a major contributor to climate change. If you start getting into the blame game, though, there, I think you have to start looking in a number of directions. So, they might be burning fossil fuels to produce electricity, but guess who's on the other end of the wire? Turning the lights on in their house, turning the air conditioner on in their house, that's consuming that electricity. Electrical utilities, most of them are businesses, and therefore, they're responding to markets and we're the ones, who are creating those markets. That said, I think it's also important to recognize that energy companies have lots of incentives to get out in front and play a leadership role in developing new technologies and moving away from fossil energy to renewable energy, wind and solar in particular.
But let me ask you, sometimes it seems like people are demanding an all or nothing type of approach, like renewables now and get rid of all the other stuff.
Yeah.
So is that realistic? I mean, what would happen if we tried to do that?
Well, I mean, personally, I do not think that is realistic. I mean, I think achieving these kinds of changes over a very, very short time scale is invariably disruptive, and with disruption comes opposition. And we can say, well, there's political opposition from conservatives who are uninterested in climate change. But I think once you start talking about, the costs of some of these changes, again, hitting people at home in their wallets, the potential disruption to companies, that level of disruption is going to create a large amount of opposition, which is going to make it very difficult to do anything politically and socially, even if it were technically feasible.
So what are our options then? If you think we can't really make the deadlines, then what's next for us here on this planet?
Yeah, great question. Well, I mean, the point, though, is we have to recognize we're probably not going to keep climate change below 1.5 degrees, and their consequences are going to be experienced as a result, or consequences are already being experienced. And recognizing that means we have to actually start investing in the adaptation side of climate change and really investing in managing the risks so that the consequences to human beings and society and the natural environment, we're actually making progress on that front as well.
Benjamin Preston is a climate change policy researcher at the RAND Corporation. That's a think tank headquartered in Santa Monica, California. Leaders and activists from all over the world came together at the Global Climate Action Summit in San Francisco in September. The motto of the conference was, "Take ambition to the next level." Here's one of the participants.
My name's Leanne Enoch. I am the Queensland Minister for Environment and the Great Barrier Reef. I am also a Kondamooka woman, so a Noonuccal Noogee woman of the Kondamooka Nation, the first Aboriginal woman ever elected to the Queensland Parliament. And of course, Queensland is the second largest state in Australia. So climate change has impacted Queensland in many ways, actually. We've seen the impact of persistent drought for many years in some parts of the state. And of course, we've also seen back-to-back consecutive mass bleaching episodes of the Great Barrier Reef. One of the strongest messages that I've been giving to delegates that I've been meeting over the last few days is to seek to pursue thriving balance. So First Nations people know all about thriving balance, how much you should take, how much you leave behind, how do you ensure that you've got a thriving balance in the environment. We need to find what thriving balance means for us now, where the economy can still thrive, where the environment can thrive, where our communities can thrive, and of course, where our future can thrive. I stand here with 3,000 generations behind me, understanding that we are but a speck in time. But our speck in time is absolutely critical for the 3,000 generations ahead of us.
That was Leanne Enoch. She is Minister for Environment for the state of Queensland in Australia. She was speaking at the Global Climate Action Summit in San Francisco. We're talking about climate change, what it will mean to our future here on this planet. How do we adjust and survive? What are some new things we have to start thinking about? Let's take a look at climate change and our health, one condition specifically, asthma. Millions of people have it, and warming temperatures could really affect how often they have attacks and how bad they are. Reporter Alan Yu has been looking into this. Hey, Alan.
Hi, Maiken.
So what do people say about climate change?
So interestingly, when you ask people with asthma what affects them, climate change is not top of their mind. They're more concerned with things that they can see and feel right now.
All kinds of trucks rolling through, kicking up all kinds of, dirt is dirt, but this is dirty dirt. Dust flying all over the place, and you got to breathe that stuff.
It's like sometimes you come outside, it looks muggy looking, smoky looking, and it has a smell to it all the time. That's every day, not only some days, just every day.
So it sounds like there's a lot to worry about already.
Yes, but climate change is on the minds of experts, people like pediatrician Tyra Bryant-Stevens.
Whether, in fact, climate change is contributing to more asthma or not, it's hard to say, but we do know that it definitely impacts asthma attacks and asthma hospitalizations.
Tyra is medical director and founder of the Community Asthma Prevention Program at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia.
Anything that increases airway inflammation is going to increase asthma symptoms and asthma attacks.
So what is the exact connection here? How is climate change going to make asthma worse than it already is?
Okay, climate change 101. Burning fossil fuels like oil, coal, and gas puts more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. That changes the climate. And carbon dioxide is one of the raw materials in photosynthesis. That's the process that plants use to make food. More carbon dioxide means plants grow faster. And research shows that plants like ragweed and pine trees could release pollen sooner and release more of it, leading to a longer pollen season. And more pollen is, of course, bad news for people with asthma or allergies.
And when I think about asthma as a condition, Alan, there are already a bunch of factors that are really out of the control of individual people, right? It gets worse in terms of where you live or what you're exposed to.
Right. So let's zoom in on that and look at factors in our environment or in people's neighborhoods. Let's look in particular at one family. I met Angela Sutton. She has two sons. Both of them have asthma. Angela says she wonders if the asthma started because of where they lived, in a Philadelphia neighborhood called Germantown.
So when you would come out, sometimes you could walk in a puff of marijuana, or, you know, the neighbors was always cigarette butts everywhere.
The boy's father and grandmother were both heavy smokers. Their apartment was in a mice-infested building.
Unfortunately, nobody's holding these landlords accountable, so they're able to just rent out anything. Everybody had breathing problems. Everybody. Like, everybody had a pump. Like, if one of your kids was outside at the playground, you could borrow somebody else's pump just to make sure they get some albuterol. I had to lend my pump out plenty of times.
When I was at her house, I also met Angela's oldest son. Jazeer Sutton is 17.
I like to dance. I consider myself a dancer. I like to play video games. I like to watch movies. Like, you know, typical teenager stuff.
About 10 years ago, he had a really scary incident.
I could not breathe at all, so we had called an ambulance truck, and they had put an oxygen tank on me, but it still wasn't working, so they had to rush me to the hospital, and they had to combine a steroid mixed with some other medicines in order to open up my lungs, because I just wasn't getting any oxygen.
Eventually, Angela moved her family to a different neighborhood, but that was hard for her financially. That move, her rent almost doubled afterwards, and that was a cost she had to shoulder on her own. Mike, and so these are the kinds of challenges that some public health people are looking at when they take care of people with asthma. These are not just personal problems.
Asthma is really about atmosphere. You know, it's not just about what's happening in the individual body, but it's about what we are breathing. And our breathing spaces are collective.
That's Ali Kenner, a professor of politics at Drexel University. She's been studying the experiences of people with asthma since 2009 and recently wrote a book called Breathtaking, Asthma Care in the Time of Climate Change.
Climate change is really pushing the issue here. Historically, you know, at least since the, you know, 1980s when the asthma epidemic emerged here in the U.S., you know, public health researchers, caregivers, doctors have talked about addressing asthma in terms of triggers. These are singular things: mold, pollen, dander, air pollution, cold air, exercise. So these are just singular things, but those aren't really how we live. We don't live through singular things.
And Alan, it sounds like Ali Kenner is thinking about all of these factors coming together. And I was thinking about the mom we just met, Angela, and how she moved her family from one part of Philadelphia to another to lessen the triggers they were experiencing. But now I'm thinking about a future where maybe we can't get away from these triggers because they'll be everywhere.
Right, so unfortunately, Ali Kenner's picture of what the future will look like, backed by the research, is that it could just be getting worse for people like Angela Sutton's two sons and other people with asthma. So, for example, climate change means more air pollution from things like ground-level ozone, and again, a longer pollen season and more extreme weather events.
And weather is another big trigger, right, when you have asthma?
Yes, that's something I heard a lot about from Jeffrey Coulter. He was diagnosed with asthma when he was 11.
Every time the season does change, I normally have a bad asthma attack where I have to get rushed to the emergency room because I'm gasping for air and my asthma pump at the time is not working.
Another issue that could change with changing weather is mold, because more flooding could mean more mold in houses. Jeffrey actually helps people retrofit their homes to help them save money. And running into mold is a risk at his job. He was doing work at a client's house.
And I went into the basement and I could not breathe at all. And the lady said, "What's wrong?" I said, "You have mold down here because it's killing my lungs right now."
So mold could be getting worse because of climate change, more pollen, air pollution could get worse, crazier weather patterns. That sounds like a lot. What do public health people say they want to do about this? Or are they just sort of shooting off a warning flare at this moment?
Right. Annie Kenner says one thing we could be pushing for are stricter regulations around air quality and air pollution. And we were kind of outside on a busy street at this point.
Is it politically feasible? We need to make it politically feasible. I mean, we're talking about public health. And if you look at the research on the public health impacts of air pollution, it far exceeds asthma alone.
And she says hopefully the work from her and other asthma researchers will get the policymakers to pay attention.
Thanks, Alan.
Thanks, Maiken.
You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Maiken Scott. And the researcher we just heard from in Alan's story basically said people need to push for stricter regulations. They need to make their voices heard. That's something a lot of Americans are already doing. They are out there demanding action on climate change in protests and marches. And some protesters think it's time for another step. They are sitting down and getting arrested. Audio producer and climate activist Claire Schoen is considering that next step herself. She has a podcast called Stepping Up, and she asked two women who've been arrested what that's like.
It's scary to put yourself on the line and risk arrest. And I have to think about that every time, whether I am ready to get sprayed by tear gas or water or be left in the rain or have my handcuffs too tight or have my arm dislocated from being pulled. But that is the reason why civil disobedience is powerful, because it's not easy.
That's Sarah Shore. She's an organizer with 350.org. It's an international climate action group mobilizing people around the world.
I've attended a lot of protests and rallies. I've done a lot on social media. I've called a lot of people to get them involved. I've organized coalition letters. I've made banners. Yeah, lots of things. And I've gotten arrested 3 times now.
That's fine for a 23-year-old. But what about someone who's in her 60s, like me? Should I get arrested?
Claire, that is just so stupid.
That's my good friend Eve.
It seems kind of dumb if you ask me. I mean, what do you want to get arrested for? You know, it sounds like you want to do something good in the world, but I don't think it's a good idea.
She had some pretty good points.
First of all, I don't think that most people in the establishment have much respect for people who are out there protesting in a way that they actually want to get arrested. The people who are going to make the laws are, you know, they're not radical people. They are much more centrist. They may think that these hippy-dippy people were outliers.
Actually, there are some older women in the climate movement who are engaging in civil disobedience. No longer hippies, they're grandmothers now.
I'm Nancy Feinstein.
Nancy is a grandmother and helped found a group of climate change activists called 1,000 Grandmothers. The group took their name from an anti-war song from the 1980s.
Sending 1,000 grandmothers, they will surely volunteer.
The song provides inspiration for them in today's fight against the climate crisis.
I think 1,000 grandmothers was a catalyst for a number of elder women to get off our butts and do whatever we could in community with each other.
Getting off their butts and getting arrested.
The sounds of protesters could be heard from blocks away as they demonstrated against the Keystone XL oil pipeline.
The first time I got arrested was with my mom.
I should mention at this point that Sarah Shore is Nancy Feinstein's daughter.
Over 1,200 people got arrested. Me and my mom were two of those people.
They fastened their wrists to the fence and waited to be arrested.
It was really nice to do it with my mom. And I think part of it was her wanting to do something with me.
I don't know. I am always looking for opportunities to hang out with my daughter. But I can't get my friend Eve's voice out of my head.
Why would you want to put yourself in that situation? You know, voluntarily to get yourself in a place that's dangerous where you could get hurt and then not be able to do the work that you want to do afterwards. There's just no way. There's no way I'd want to do anything like that.
I asked Sarah, why not simply write my congresswoman?
When you see people putting their bodies on the line, it makes people pay attention. For example, in the civil rights movement, people breaking unjust laws, like sitting at the lunch counters or riding at the front of the bus and seeing African Americans get beat up by police and police dogs made the public realize this is not fair. And it completely changed the American perception of segregation in this country.
But still, why can't I leave this arrest business to the millennials? Then I caught a speech that Bill McKibben gave after the Keystone XL arrest action that Nancy and Sarah were both part of. Bill's the founder of Sarah's organization, 350.org.
Young people have led this fight, which is appropriate. But one of the few unmixed blessings of growing older is, past a certain point, what the hell are they going to do to you? You know? And so it was great to go to Washington and see that there were a lot of people with hairline like mine showing up. The point I'm trying to make for young people is just that your elders are starting to act like elders, okay? And that I think they will be with you as this fight goes forward. Thank you all so much.
That was a bit of a revelation for me. So I signed up and became one of the 1,000 grandmothers. I don't actually have grandkids, but the group uses the Native American definition of grandmother, an elder woman who cares about the next 7 generations. And as Nancy says, grandmothers can afford to do this.
Older women can actually step up in ways that maybe when we were first trying to establish ourselves, we couldn't, or when we were raising children, we couldn't.
Of course, the downside is we're old and a little creaky.
All of us have had conversations about this because many of us had physical disabilities.
That has made me more worried when I get arrested with my mom because she's less, you know, physically able and she's more stressed out about being in the back of a police wagon or being made to sit in a position that is painful. So I worry more for her in terms of physical discomfort than myself.
I feel more willing to take some risk because I can't think of anything more important.
You have to identify with a grandmother. If the public sees a grandmother getting arrested for a cause that they believe in, it makes you think twice. And so I'm really excited about the prospect of 1,000 grandmothers rising up, organizing grandmothers all over the place. I think that that's incredibly powerful.
You know, people always say you would put yourself on a train track if it protected your children. That's kind of how I feel about this climate struggle. I don't think of myself as a particularly courageous person, but if I ever needed to be courageous, it's now.
And for me, I'll continue to march and write my congresswoman and sign petitions to support climate action. And while the idea of getting arrested is scary, I am ready to take that step too.
That's audio producer Claire Schoen. To hear the full story and other surprising stories of climate activists, check out her podcast, Stepping Up. We heard some music in this piece from Blue Dot Sessions and Holly Neer. We're talking about climate change. The new UN report states that humans have to take serious action to reduce warming over the next 10 years or face some dire consequences. In the meantime, many researchers are looking into adaptive strategies, ways to mitigate the impact of warming temperatures, to protect ourselves, our cities, our infrastructure. Here's a candidate that could help form a barrier against rising seas, mangroves.
So there are those trees that look kind of like jungle gyms.
That's biologist Samantha Chapman. She studies wetland ecosystems, including mangroves. She does most of her work at the Kennedy Space Center in Florida. Mangroves like it there, but they grow in tropical and subtropical waters all over the world. Climate change could mean more storms, rising sea levels, and big destructive waves. And Samantha says mangroves with their jungle gym shape could help lessen that damage.
They have all these big roots and things called pneumatophores, which are like little snorkels that stick up that allow them to breathe in the water. And all of that structure actually breaks up the energy of a wave as it kind of comes in.
So you are looking at mangroves as a barrier.
That is one of the ways in which we're looking at them. We're also looking at them, and perhaps most importantly, as sort of a builder of land. So mangroves are very good at building land, like salt marsh grasses are. So in order to keep up with rising sea levels that have been rising, you know, since the last ice age, they've had to sort of build up soil, and they do this in two ways. They both catch the dirt that's running down rivers and coming in on coastal events. So they catch that sediment and they trap it and they build up the land that way. But they also do that by growing roots and sort of pushing the soil up. And so in doing so, they can form their own land, which is pretty amazing, especially when we're thinking about losing so much land to things like sea level rise.
And with temperatures warming, could we see mangroves in areas where so far they haven't been able to survive?
So thus far, mangroves in Florida, where I'm working, have reached kind of the limits of where they were in the past. But this is like the long ago past. But they've been steadily, since the 80s, moving up the coast. The one thing mangroves can't deal with are freeze events, and it hasn't been freezing as much anymore in Florida. And so they're sort of marching up the coast in Florida, and they're doing the same thing in Texas and Louisiana and other places in the United States, as well as other places in the world. I just spent a sabbatical in New Zealand, and the same thing is happening there. They're changing their extent there as well.
So if we're talking mangroves, what would we do? Would we plant them in all kinds of places?
It is not that hard to create new coastal wetlands. China is doing an amazing job of it, right? So they are planting vast areas of new mangroves. I've traveled there recently a couple times to see some of the work that they're doing, right? Coming back from ecological disasters in many cases and are planting lots of mangroves and lots of other types of wetlands to sort of clean up their ecosystems, right? And trap carbon. One of the things that's tricky with mangroves is you have to get the water flow right. And so you have to know kind of how much of that dirt's going to be delivered into those systems to allow them to build that land. But in terms of the planting itself, they have these seeds that float, right? You can get a bunch of them, they make lots of them, and you sort of stick them in the ground. And if you have the conditions right, you can build vast mangrove forests really quickly.
How do you think about nature's ability to adapt with warming temperatures, how the earth might adapt and change?
Yeah, and this is definitely a personal opinion that's not shared by everyone, but I tend to think that nature is resilient when we either leave it alone or give it a little bit of help to do what it needs to do. An example of that is the fact that these plants and animals are moving around with climate change. Not all plants can move. Mangroves are good at that because they have things that float. But there are, you know, maples that are becoming more abundant in northern areas, right, that are changing with this climate. But I think that we need to provide the room for nature to adjust to climate change, you know, and it's going to adjust with or without us. That's the way I think about it, right? Nature is going to be here. The earth will be here. It's just whether it's a a sustainable place for us to live or not is the real question.
Samantha Chapman is a biology professor at Villanova University near Philadelphia. She studies wetland ecosystems. Another strategy to adapt and to prevent the worst is to try to get rid of some of the carbon dioxide we pump into the atmosphere, 36 billion tons globally every year. What if we could capture that greenhouse gas and store it somewhere safely? To introduce us to a technology called carbon sequestration, reporter Shayla Farzan went to one of the sources of the problem.
Okay. Kind of sitting on the side of the road here, maybe about a quarter of a mile from the Meramec power plant, which is a mostly coal-fired power plant about a half hour south of St. Louis. One, two, three, four big smokestacks over there are releasing greenhouse gases like carbon dioxide, and that carbon dioxide is changing the climate. So how do we keep all of this carbon dioxide from going into the atmosphere? Well, one way is we can trap it at the source where it's being released, like this power plant here. But the question is, all right, you've trapped it, what are you going to do with it? And that's where this technology called carbon sequestration comes in.
That involves taking carbon dioxide that's captured, putting it someplace where it can be stored over very long time periods, hundreds to thousands of years.
That's Dan Jamar. He's a professor of environmental engineering at Washington University, and he's also an expert in geochemistry. The process of carbon sequestration is pretty straightforward. You inject carbon dioxide underground where it reacts with the surrounding rock and water. Then slowly that gas becomes rock itself. The way Dan describes it, it sounds a little like science fiction, but it's not a new technology. Research scientists have actually been injecting carbon dioxide into sandstone deposits for decades. When you're looking for a good place to put CO2, sandstone comes to mind for one big reason. It's full of holes. And that's a good thing. It means the carbon dioxide can seep into all of its little cracks and crevices. But the problem is, once it's there, that gas can take thousands of years to turn into rock.
The carbon dioxide stored there remains as essentially this CO2 bubble that's trapped beneath a roof.
You can see why this would be an issue. If there's a crack in the overlying rock, all that carbon dioxide can escape. And because carbon dioxide is acidic, if it gets into the groundwater, it can cause lead and other heavy metals to leach out of the rock.
Then you have contaminated potentially shallow groundwater, which we might use for drinking water, with carbon dioxide. And also, quite importantly, that CO2, if it makes it back to the surface and goes back to the atmosphere, there was no point in trying to store it in the first place.
So sandstone might not be an ideal rock for storing CO2. Dan says a better candidate might be a type of volcanic rock that's actually one of the most common rock types on Earth. It's called basalt. Basalt reacts with carbon dioxide and turns the gas into limestone. What Dan studies is how fast that process happens under different conditions. We met up at his lab in St. Louis so I could see this process in person. And the first thing you notice when you walk into his lab is this row of metal chambers sitting on the counter. They're about the size of a soda can, and inside each one, Dan simulates the conditions that you'd find underground. Each chamber is a different mix of variables, like temperature and pressure.
And then sitting down in the water, we have a core of basalt. And so we have a rock that has these natural pores in it. It's sitting down in water. There's a lot of carbon dioxide dissolving into that water. And then there would be carbonate minerals forming inside this piece of rock.
Remember, Dan's trying to figure out how fast carbon dioxide turns into rock inside these little soda can-sized pressure cookers. And it turns out it's actually pretty fast.
A lot of people had said, well, maybe the carbonate minerals would form over decades. We had thought from our understanding of the chemical reactions it would happen much faster, and indeed it did. So we start to see carbonate minerals forming as early as 6 weeks in some of our experiments.
So that sounds promising. In less than 2 months, carbon dioxide starts to turn into rock. But the question is, how feasible would it be to try to do this on a large scale, the kind of scale that we'd need to start to address climate change? To figure that out, I got in touch with David Goldberg. He's a geology and geophysics professor at Columbia University, and he says location plays a really big role.
Every basalt will react at a little bit different rate. It depends on the pressure constraints, how deep it is. It depends on how much CO2 is injected, how dry the CO2 is.
In other words, you might have a basalt deposit under your house, but that doesn't mean it's a good candidate for carbon sequestration. David also says the technology for injecting carbon dioxide underground is basically the same technology that's used in oil and gas exploration. The obvious difference here is that someone's paying those companies to drill for oil and gas. And right now, David says there's not really a financial incentive for companies to do carbon sequestration.
They won't be doing it with an altruistic motive only. It may start that way, but I think in the long run, to maintain this, there needs to be a financial structure that makes the incentive for the commercial sector to do this.
We're still a ways off from being able to do carbon sequestration commercially. But scientists like Dan and David say they're doing the research now in the hopes that those financial incentives will be there someday. For The Pulse, I'm Shayla Farzan.
We've been talking about climate change, and let's finish with a young woman who says her generation is ready to tackle these issues.
My name is Jayathma Vikramanayake. I am the United Nations Secretary General's envoy on youth.
And she says global policy conversations about climate change have to involve young people.
It is about us having to live in a world, or us having to be leaders of a world that we did not create. And I have not met a single young person who does not believe in climate change or who does not take climate change seriously. I have seen young people questioning the clothes they wear, questioning the products that they eat. So in that sense, I think there is a strong conscience in young people that we shouldn't leave the world in the way that we found it. We should make it a better place for our children or for the future generations to live. And on the other side, we have no other option. If this generation does not reverse these implications, then we are going downhill. So that is my call to action.
That's the envoy on youth of the United Nations Secretary General. She attended the Climate Summit in San Francisco. All of our postcards from the summit were produced by Carolyn Beeler. She's the environment reporter for PRI's The World. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Thanks to the producers at Imagine If, that's a podcast about climate resiliency from the North American Association for Environmental Education. You can hear the whole story about Bailey, the teenage cattle farmer, on their website. Our health and science reporters are Alan Yu and Liz Tung. Our intern is Julian Harris. Charlie Kyer is our engineer, and this week we had help from Mike Villers. Alex Stern is our associate producer, Tanya English, our editorial director. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Behavioral health reporting on The Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated health care.
WHYY's health and science reporting is supported by a generous grant from Public Health Management Corporation's Public Health Fund. PHMC gladly supports WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.
Supporting The Pulse, the Coriell Institute for Medical Research, enabling scientific discovery around the world through its renowned collections of cell lines and DNA from the National Institute on Aging and National Institute for General Medical Sciences. Learn more at coriell.org.